Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So here we go. The Dantabhumi Sutta, number 125 of the Majjhima Nikaya. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel sanctuary. And those of you who have been on pilgrimage can go to the bamboo grove. Because we have the hot springs in Rajagaha, and they obviously haven't changed their location over the last 25 centuries, from the location of the hot springs you can locate where many of the other places where the Buddha lived around Rajagaha are located. And the bamboo grove is not that far, just a walking distance from the hot springs. Now, on that occasion, the novice Achiravata was living in a forest hut. Thence Prince Jayasena, while wandering and walking for exercise, went to the novice Achiravata and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down on one side and said to the novice Achiravata, Master Akiwesana, that's just a clan name, I have heard that a bhikkhu who abides here diligent, ardent, and resolute can achieve unification of mind. You know, a bhikkhu is the monk, bhikkhuni is the nun. Unification of mind is ekagata. And for those of you who know the meaning of that word, it's sometimes called one-pointedness of mind, but that misses an important part of that word. It's ek-aga-ta. Eka is one, and aga is the Pali word, and its Sanskrit equivalent is agra. And some of you have been to Agra in India, and literally it means capital or peak or summit. It was the capital of the Mughal Empire in India. So what it's meaning here, very clearly, is one summit of the mind, one peak of the mind. I fear that a monk who abides here diligent, ardent, and resolute can achieve unification of mind, one peak of mind, which is always a jhanas. That is so, Prince, that is so. A bhikkhu who abides here diligent, ardent, and resolute can achieve this one peak of mind. It would be good if Master Agiwesana would teach me the Dhamma as he has heard it and mastered it. So this little novice was being asked to teach some Dhamma. And the novice says, I cannot teach you the Dharma, Prince, as I have heard and mastered it, for if I were to teach you the Dharma as I have heard and mastered it, you would not understand the meaning of my words, and that would be wearing and troublesome for me. So sometimes when people ask questions, I should try that. I said, if I were to answer your question, it might be wearisome and trouble for me. But I haven't done that yet. No, because he obviously was thinking that the prince was too conceited to really understand what was being said. Let Master Agiwesana teach me the Dhamma as he has heard and mastered it. Perhaps I can understand the meaning of his words. Okay, I shall teach you the Dhamma, Prince, as I have heard it and mastered it. If you can understand the meaning of my words, that will be good. But if you cannot understand the meaning, then leave it at that and don't question me about it further. That was a smart novice. That's also a way you can actually talk to your husband or your wife. You know, this is what I say. If you don't understand it, leave it at that. Don't question about me afterwards. Very smart in those days. Let Master Agiwesana teach him the Dharma as he has heard it and mastered it. If I can understand the meaning of his words, that will be good. If I cannot understand the meaning, then I will leave it at that and will not question him about it further. Then the novice Achiravata taught Prince Jayasena the Dhamma as he had heard and mastered it. And after he had spoken, Prince Jayasena remarked, It is impossible, Master Agiwesana. It cannot happen that a monk who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute can achieve unification of mind. Then having declared to the novice Achiravata that this was impossible and could not happen, Prince Jayasena rose from his seat and departed. So obviously that he wasn't convinced with the poor little novice. So, soon after Prince Jayasena had left, the novice Achiravata went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Buddha, he sat down on one side and reported to the Blessed One the entire conversation with the prince.
When he had finished, the Blessed One said to him, Agyuesana, saying to the novice, how is it possible that Prince Jayasena, living in the midst of sensual pleasures, enjoying sensual pleasures, being devoured by thoughts of sensual pleasures, being consumed by the fever of sensual pleasures, bent on the search for sensual pleasures, could know, see or realize that which must be known through renunciation, seen through renunciation, attained through renunciation, realized through renunciation? That is impossible. So because he was a prince, he was really into his sensuality. And he was just basically going up to these little novices trying to attack them. And the novice said, it's possible to do this. And he said, ah, it's impossible. How can anyone sort of do that sort of stuff? And the Buddha was saying, well, you have to at least lessen, if not sort of renounce your sensual pleasures. And as lay people, when you go on retreats, that's what you do. No TVs, no radios, no entertainment, no singing and dancing. So you renounce your pleasures for those days you're on retreat, and then of course not being consumed by the sensual pleasures, the path to deep meditation is open to you. Or that many of you live very simple lives at home, and so in such case you're not like a prince who is living in the midst of sensual pleasures. And the Buddha gives another simile. Suppose, Agyuesana, there were two tameable elephants, horses or oxen, that were well tamed and well disciplined, and two tameable elephants, horses or oxen, that were untamed and undisciplined. What do you think, Agyuesana? Would the two tameable elephants, horses or oxen, that were well tamed and well disciplined, being tamed, acquire the behavior of the tamed? Would they arrive at the grade of the tamed? Of course, Venerable Sir. But would the two tameable elephants, horses or oxen that were untamed and undisciplined, being untamed, acquire the behavior of the tamed? Would they arrive at the grade of the tamed, like the two tameable elephants, horses or oxen that were well tamed and well disciplined? No, Venerable Sir. So to Agyuesana, it is impossible that Prince Jayasena, living in the midst of sensual pleasures, could know, see or realize that which must be known through renunciation, seen through renunciation, attained through renunciation, realized through renunciation. He hasn't tamed his mind yet. Suppose, Agyuesana, this is a nice simile, there were a high mountain not far from a village or town, and two friends would leave the village or town and approach the mountain hand in hand. Which shows that when two friends had hand in hand, it didn't mean they were gay in the time of the Buddha, it just meant they were friends. Having reached it, one friend would remain below at the foot of the mountain, while the other would climb to the top. Then the friend who remained below at the foot of the mountain would say to the friend who stood at the top, well, friend, what do you see standing on top of the mountain? And the other replied, standing on top of the mountain, friend, I see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds. Then the first friend would say, it is impossible, friend, it cannot happen, that while standing on top of the mountain you should see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds. Then the other friend would come down to the foot of the mountain, take his friend by the arm and make him climb to the top of the mountain. After giving him a few moments to catch his breath, he would ask, well, friend, standing on top of the mountain, what do you see? And his friend would reply, wow, standing on top of the mountain, friend, I too see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows and lovely ponds. Then the other would say, friend, just a little earlier we heard you say, it is impossible, it cannot happen, that while standing on top of this mountain you should see such lovely things. But just now we heard you say, standing on top of the mountain, I do see these lovely things. Then the first friend would reply, because I was obstructed by this high mountain, friend, I did not see what was there to be seen. So too, Agyuesana, Prince Jayasena is obstructed, hindered, blocked and enveloped by a still greater mass than this, the mass of ignorance. Thus it is impossible that Prince Jayasena, living in the midst of sensory pleasures, could know, see or realize that which must be known through renunciation, seen through renunciation, attained through renunciation, and realized through renunciation. So this is one of the common problems which you face, like as a monk, or as any sort of one who's trying to teach Buddhism, to try and teach people the beauty of something like meditation, and just how much peace and fun, how lovely the mountains and the ponds and the meadows are when you stand right on top. And sometimes people say it's impossible, you can't do that. You're just making it up. So your job as a monk is to come down and take your disciples by the hand, lead them up to the top of the mountain, give you time to catch your breath, and say, wow, there we can see sort of the lovely ponds, the lovely meadows, and the lovely fields and groves. So that's obviously through experience. And this, of course, sometimes all the stuff which you say about the nature of the mind, you do need to stand on top of that mountain to be able to actually to see, because on top of the mountain you're not obstructed by the great mass of ignorance. And also, it's making a strong point here that the sensory pleasures, being stuck to them, is what stops the achievement of the unification of mind. There's another simile which we'd like to talk about in the monastery. It's a simile of the three pieces of wood. Now, the first pieces of wood is just taken out of the water, it's all wet and soggy. And he said, you can't use that piece of wood to light a fire. Even the second piece of wood is taken out of the water, but it's lying close by. So even on the outside it's dry, inside it's still sappy. Even that, you can't light a fire with that. But the other piece of wood has been out of the water for a long time, it's a long way from the river, and it's dry to the very core, and that easily takes the flame. And this is one of the Buddha's simile, and he said, this is like the attainment of the jhanas. If you just take yourself out of the sensory world, you know, you're sort of all soggy and wet. I'm talking about your mind. It's really hard for it to take a light and to get the jhanas. It's using a simile which is very clear in Pali, because the word for jhana is actually to burn. It's the same word to burn. So using a metaphor here which is very clear in the Pali. And even if you've taken the piece of wood out of the water, and it's dry on the outside but still sappy on the inside, so you may not be sort of breaking any of the 5-8 precepts, but you're still sometimes thinking of sensory thoughts while in the meditation retreat, which means you still really can't sort of light the fire. But if you sort of take the mind out of the sensory world, let it dry out for a few days in a meditation retreat, so that all the sensory thoughts are just fade away, then it's to take the flame, like a very dry stick. That's one of the Buddha's similes. It's the same with... Sorry, yes, go on. No, it's just the same with, you know, even like monks. Sometimes you can take a monk, which is outside of the sensory realm, but they can still think sensory thoughts or fantasies. Which means on the outside they're dry, but on the inside they're still wet. Which is one of the reasons why they wouldn't get deep meditation. Yeah. Okay, you're saying for the sake of the recording that sometimes that in life that you hear some beautiful music and it really takes hold of your mind and takes the mind out, and you realize that that can be an obstacle. I do remember as a monk for many, many years in the forest not hearing music. Whenever you did hear music, it was always the Thai music and I couldn't understand it. It didn't really grab you. But then going to Bangkok to do my visa, I heard some Western music. Just somebody was passing by where I was staying, just with, in those days used to call it ghetto blaster. And I couldn't get it out of my head for days. It was amazing just how sensitive your mind was. It kept on repeating it, and it was just awful. And sometimes that stuff can obsess you. And it's just because I grabbed onto it very quickly, and I couldn't get it out once it grabbed onto it. So, those sorts of things that sometimes in our world, even myself, you can't avoid hearing these things. Very often these days in funeral services, people always try and play the favorite music of the person who passed away. And now I'm getting to that sort of age that many people of my generation are passing away. So their favourite music is my favourite music as well when I was young. So it's a bit dangerous now, but sometimes these things happen. And you know, you gain the ability more, Daniel, of being able just to let things go. So you have to hear it, but then you sort of cut it afterwards, you let the past go. So I think it must be that you don't delight in it, you don't grab onto it when you hear it. I think that's basically the only thing you can really do. Because you can't avoid, I can't avoid music. Because, you know, in our modern society, it's all around you. Just music, yeah. It's just not going to get you anyway. Yes, Bonnie? Is that why that in the tradition of training for monks and nuns, you're supposed to stay in the monastery for 5 years before you let loose on the world? It is for that, so that you can learn your precepts, learn the ropes of being like a monk, what you're supposed to do, your charity, but also to learn enough restraint so that you're strong enough to resist all those things which can very easily obsess your mind. It's also why that in monasteries, why we have these rules, why monks and nuns should not have televisions. And sometimes you see monks do have TVs in their monasteries. You know, why you're supposed to not have, at least they're sort of in Asian countries, and why you're not supposed to have any entertainments. In other words, so that your mind is free from those sensory experiences. I remember the first time I saw a television, I think after 7 years of being a monk. It was, I think, with Ajahn Sumedho visiting a person's house. And while we were waiting before we were going to go and give a talk, we just saw the door was open, I could see the television in the opposite room. And not having seen a television, not even once for 7 years, it was just so jarring on the senses. It was actually painful to watch, because the images were firing so fast. And when you've just been in a monastery in a forest for 7 years, you see those images coming at you, coming at you, coming at you. It was actually doing violence to your mind. That's what I thought at the time. But people get used to it. But anyway, going back to the sutta, this paragraph 11, Agyuwesana, if these two similes had occurred to you with reference to Prince Jayasena, he would have spontaneously acquired confidence in you, and being confident would have shown his confidence to you. And the novice quite understandably objects, Venerable Sir, how could these two similes have occurred to me with reference to Prince Jayasena, as they occur to the Blessed One, since they are spontaneous and have never been heard before? So I think the Buddha accepts that. Suppose Agyuwesana, a head anointed noble king, addresses his elephant woodsman thus, Good elephant woodsman, mount the king's elephant and enter the elephant wood, and when you see a forest elephant, bind him by the neck to the king's elephant. Having replied, Yes, sire, the elephant woodsman mounts the king's elephant, enters the elephant wood, and when he sees a forest elephant, binds him by the neck to the king's elephant. And the king's elephant leads him out into the open. It is in this way that a forest elephant comes out into the open, for the forest elephant clings to the elephant wood. I think you can obviously understand the simile over here. So in order to get a person out of the sensory wood, you bind him or her to like a good monk or good nun, to take you out of the forest. So that's why you could need good teachers to take people out, because otherwise the forest elephant would not come out. Then the elephant woodsman informs the head anointed noble king, Sire, the forest elephant has come out into the open. The king addresses his elephant tamer thus, Come, good elephant tamer, tame the forest elephant, subdue his forest habits, subdue his forest memories and intentions, subdue his distress, fatigue and fever over leaving the forest, get him to take delight in the town, inculcate in him habits congenial to human beings. Having replied, Yes, sire, the elephant tamer plants a large post in the earth and binds the forest elephant to it by the neck in order to subdue his forest habits and to inculcate him habits congenial to human beings. And I think you know the simile of the post That's mindfulness, to keep the mind aware so it's bound to the post of mindfulness so it doesn't wander too far into dangerous habitats. Then the elephant tamer addresses the elephant with words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear and lovable, as go to the heart and courteous, desired by many and agreeable to many. When the forest elephant is addressed by such words, he listens, gives ear, and exerts his mind to understand. Now that's an important point. When you're taming an elephant, you can't sort of shout at the elephant, "Stupid elephant, come and do what I tell you." You don't shout and get angry and beat the elephant. In this simile here, you use words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. Because when the forest elephant is addressed by such words, they listen, give ear, and exert the mind to understand. So here straight away you're hearing how people should teach one another. Again, this is a simile. I've already mentioned taking the forest elephant out of the forest is a simile of taking people out of the forest of sensuality and stupidity into a more meaningful, wise life, peaceful life. So you don't do that by shouting at people, by being kind, by being compassionate, using the soft, gentle approach. The elephant tamer next rewards him with the grass, fodder and water. And when the forest elephant accepts the grass, fodder and water from him, the elephant tamer knows now the king's elephant will live. So as soon as you get the first rewards from living a restrained, peaceful life, restrained, for example, as a layperson by the five precepts, and you get rewards from that, then you know that you're going to survive with the five precepts. Then the elephant tamer trains him further, thus, take up, put down. When the king's elephant obeys his tamer's orders to take up and put down and carries out his instructions, the elephant tamer trains him further, thus, go forward, go back. When the king's elephant obeys his tamer's orders to go forward and go back and carries out his instructions, the elephant tamer trains him further, get up, sit down. When the king's elephant obeys his tamer's orders to get up and sit down and carries out his instructions, the elephant tamer trains him further in the task called imperturbability. He ties a giant plank to his trunk, with a man with a lance in his hand, sits on his neck, and men with lances in their hands surround him on all sides, and the elephant tamer himself stands in front of him holding a long lance pole. When the elephant is being trained in the task of imperturbability, he does not move his forelegs or his hind legs. He does not move his forequarters or his hindquarters. He does not move his head, ears, tusk, tail or trunk. And the king's elephant is able to endure blows from spears, swords, arrows, other beings, and the thundering sounds of drums, kettle drums, trumpets and tom-toms. Being rid of all the faults and defects, purge of all flaws, he is worthy of the king, and the king's service is considered one of the factors of a king. So hopefully you can get the similarity, the simile here. In the time of the Buddha, it was a very, obviously, a military similes which the Buddha was using. The elephant was like the tank used by armies in those days. But just teaching an elephant to be trained, especially in imperturbability, we're now going to have the simile of the gradual training here, but the meaning of this simile is that eventually, if you're going to learn how to meditate, you have to be imperturbable. There may be not the sound of the kettle drums and other drums, but certainly there's the sound of the dogs, the crows, and the neighbor next door when you're trying to meditate. So you have to be trained in imperturbability. And I would never forget the story of one of the disciples who was from the Armadale group, a young lady with two young children. And every time she wanted to meditate at home, her daughter, her son, would pull her hair, climb all over her, and say, "Mummy, Mummy, I want a glass of water. Mummy, Mummy, I want this. Mummy, Mummy, I want that." And of course, she'd always have to get up to give her children things. But one day, she decided to practice imperturbability. And so she sat down there, and of course, only after 1 or 2 minutes, "Mummy, Mummy, I want a drink of water. Mummy, Mummy, I want to go and take a poo." And Mummy didn't move. And then they started again, climbing over her, pulling her hair. "Mummy, Mummy, I really need you." And she didn't move. She endured all the pulling of the hair, the climbing over her, the poking her. And then the kids got serious. "Mummy, Mummy, Jane's got a kitchen knife from the drawer. Mummy, Mummy, David's turned on the gas and is playing with matches." And that's actually true, that's what she said. And then, of course, she didn't move. She called their bluff. And after a while, they fell silent, and she just carried on meditating for half an hour. And after half an hour, she opened her eyes and noticed playing quietly in the corner. They hadn't sliced each other's arms off. They hadn't blown up the house. This was just, she gained her imperturbability. And from that time on, she said, whenever she meditated, she sat down, the kids would leave her alone. They realized there's no way they're getting her mum's attention anymore. She's meditating. So she won her opportunity. So that's a very good lesson in how to be imperturbability. Just like the king's elephants. So that's when you want to meditate and your wife says, darling, 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 come on, you've got to go out. Be imperturbable and just stay there. So from that, the Buddha starts going into the gradual training. Now I like mentioning this gradual training because this is core Buddhism. This is repeated so many times in the suttas. But just because it's repeated so many times, it doesn't mean we should always just skim over it. It's because it's repeated so many times, this is the core practice. This is the way to Nibbana. This is the Eightfold Path in practice. So this is the way. So we start on paragraph 13. So too, talking to the novice, Agyavesana, a Tathagata, which is the way the Buddha would talk about himself. A Tathagata appears in the world accomplished, fully enlightened. He teaches the Dhamma and somebody gets faith in the Dhamma of the Buddha. And so the person shaves off their hair and beard, puts on a yellow robe and goes forth from home life into homelessness. It is in this way that a noble disciple comes out into the open, for gods and humans cling to the five cores of sensory pleasure. So this is like taking the elephant out of the forest. And even if you, for one reason or another, you can't actually go into homelessness as a monk or a nun, still there's many opportunities in your lay life to have a very simple life. In other words, you're not clinging to the five cores of sensory pleasure, but you're living a more spiritual life, even though it's at home. In other words, you don't watch the TV so much, or you don't go listen to music so much, and you live a very simple life. And then the Tathagata, the Buddha, disciplines them further. Come, monk, nun, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, which is the monastic rule for monks. 5 precepts for lay people, 8 precepts on the Poya days, see 1 Pras, see the moon days. Be perfect in conduct and resort. And resort means not putting yourself in dangerous places. So you don't go walking, around the casino at night or down Northbridge. That is called like wrong resort. And seeing fear in the slightest fault. Fear in the slightest fault means the fear of the danger of slightest faults. It doesn't mean that you are paranoid, but you just realize that if there is a fault in your precepts, that it's a danger. It's the same as like seeing fear in crossing a red light at the traffic intersection. However, as I've mentioned before, there are times when it's right to cross the red traffic lights. For example, if Ajahn Brahm has a heart attack, I would hope that you cross the red traffic lights to get me to hospital in time to save my life, as long as it's safe to do so. So if you're doing that, you get to the red traffic light and you pause to make sure it's safe to go across. And then, of course, you go across. So you see fear in transgressing the rules. Fear means you're cautious. It doesn't mean you don't always do it, but you're very cautious. You see fear in these things. It's dangerous. Seeing fear in the slightest fault, and you train by undertaking the training precepts. And when the Agyavesana, the noble disciple, is virtuous, and sees fear in the slightest faults, and trains by undertaking the training precepts, then the Tathagata disciplines them further. Come, monk or nun, guard the doors of your senses. And this is the sort of thing which you should be doing when you go on the retreats. On seeing a form with the eye, do not grasp at its signs and features. Since if you were to leave the eye faculty unguarded, even unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade you. Practice a way of restraint, guard the eye faculty, undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. So a good way of doing that is that if you are practicing on a meditation retreat or doing some meditation at home, Now, whenever you see something which might upset you or inflame you, see someone you don't like or something you don't like, sometimes we've got such a fault-finding mind. When we see there's something which isn't done properly, we get upset. And sometimes people start complaining that the bamboo floor in the retreat center is not level. If that's going to cause you a problem, guard the eye faculty and look to the part of the bamboo floor which is level. In other words, don't allow the mind to get inflamed because of what you see. You might start to see other things like a bit of dirt in the kitchen, or who don't know, maybe mouse droppings. But if you do that, I don't think there are any mouse droppings in the kitchen in the retreat center, I hope. But if you do, don't allow that to bring evil, unwholesome thoughts into the mind. Or you might see someone you really like there, especially young men, young women. So if you do that, don't allow the mind to go to such parts of their body which will give rise to lust. And you know the usual training which we say for the monks. If you do see someone who's very attractive, there's always one part of them, usually many parts of them, which are unattractive. So you can always remember the unattractive part of them. And if you can do that, it means that the mind doesn't get hot, you're still very peaceful. So you have to train to guard your eye sense. And the same to undertake restraining the ear. So on hearing a sound with the ear, again, you don't grasp at the signs and its features. Somebody might be talking in a retreat. And because you're not guarding your ear, that causes this huge amount of thinking. They shouldn't be talking. We're supposed to be keeping noble silence. Why are they doing that? And of course, because your ear faculty was unguarded, it destroys your meditation. So you guard the ear faculty. So you don't need to hear these things which cause you problem. Or again, if it's a case of music when you're going around, guard that ear faculty so when you hear the music, and if you're trying to get some nice meditation and live a very peaceful life, don't grasp at it. And then it will just, when it's finished, it doesn't linger in your mind. On smelling an odour with the nose, or tasting a flavour with the tongue, a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, you do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you were to leave the mind faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states, where it says covetous and grief here, these are actually the first two hindrances. Again, I've mentioned before, the word covetousness and grief is used in the Satipatthana. These are 130 or 40-year-old translations of the words, which are much better translated as sensory desire and ill will. The first two of the five hindrances. They might invade you. So practice a way of restraint, guard the mind faculty, undertake the restraint of the mind faculty. So what actually happens in practice when you do that, by doing like sense restraint, which means you don't mean you close your eyes, it doesn't mean you put plugs in your ears and you go around with earphones on you and with eye patches over you when you go on a meditation retreat. You don't have to wear a burqa in meditation retreats. All it really means is that you you guard. So whenever there's something which is attractive, going to wind you up, you say no to it, you turn the other way. Anything which is going to make you upset, angry, again, you turn away. So that way it's a sense of realizing the dangers of the sensory world. And it's always the case that if it's like ill will, anger, upset, you're only seeing a part of the picture. Now, one possible interpretation of the evidence which is going to make you upset. If it's like lust or liking, again, you're seeing one part, the food you're eating, which makes you get a desire coming up. And of course, what you're seeing is just its taste. You're not seeing what's going to happen afterwards, as you say, not seeing the dangers. So sense restraint is just a way of preparing yourself so that there's not so much restlessness and ill will caused, by overactivation of your five senses. Does that make sense? Okay, so this is actually training the elephant. When Aggiwesana, the noble disciple, guards the doors of his sense faculties, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, monk, be moderate in eating. reflecting wisely, you should take your food neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort and assisting the holy life, considering, I shall terminate all feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. So this is a reflection which the monks do, which you can do as well, the nuns do it as well. So why are you eating? It's not for amusement, not for physical beauty. In other words, you know, you're not eating too little just so you've got a good figure. So that's why I don't go on a diet, because it's not for the beauty of my body. Nor sometimes in some countries, like being plump was beautiful. But you don't do it for the beauty, you just do it for not for intoxication or for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body. In other words, for keeping you reasonably healthy, having enough energy inside of you, and for ending discomfort and assisting the holy life. Especially for ending discomfort, so you're not too hungry in the evening, you're not too tired. And thus I shall terminate the old feelings of hunger and tiredness and weakness without arousing new feelings of sleepiness and being sort of full. And there you'll be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. Yeah? It's just the whole of the person. So it's not just the ego, it's all the different things to train the person so that you can climb up that mountain and see what's on the top, or see what's on the other side. Overcome the mountain of ignorance. So, when Aggiwesana, the noble disciple, is moderate in eating, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, monk, be devoted to wakefulness during the day while walking back and forth and sitting, the walking meditation, sitting meditation. Purify your mind of obstructive states. In the first watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. In the middle watch of the night, you should lie down on the right side, in the lion's pose, with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in your mind the time for rising. And after rising, in the last watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. So they're talking about the three watches of the night. And I think I've never actually found out exactly what those watches of the night are. Somebody actually said it's not like 4 hours, 4 hours, 4 hours. I forget exactly what the distribution of time is, but it's not a third, a third, a third of the 12-hour night. It's something different than that. But the point is that you have a time in the evening when you're still awake. You have a time in the morning after you've woken up. The time in the middle is when you sleep. And the time before you had alarm clocks, people could note in your mind the time for rising. And even these days I ask people to try it on retreats, that when you go to bed at night, to tell yourself what time you're going to get up. And actually you don't really need alarm clocks after a while if you practice like that and you do lots of meditation, because you just wake up at that time when you tell yourself. It's one of those things which you hear here, you see here or read here in the stories of the Buddha, which things you can practice yourself. Just tell yourself when you want to wake up, and it actually works. So, well, I've tried that, and sometimes you can do it. I usually go to sleep on my right side, but usually you turn over. Why don't you start like that? But again, the whole point of the training, that sometimes I find that if I do lie down on the right side, after a while, just the shoulder gets a bit numb and starts to ache. That's just personally. So usually that's after a while. But I train myself to go to sleep on that side. And some monks, apparently, I don't know actually whether, well, I haven't really talked about it, but the whole point is just, you know, you go to sleep mindful, in a comfortable position. It's not that important to actually to go sit down. That's right. That's sometimes they say, well, why does he say to sleep on the right side? And the only difficulty in the heart must be on the left side. so that most of your body is below your heart, so it must mean it doesn't have to do so much work. Therefore, it's a more comfortable position. And if you do on your left side, much more of your body is above your heart, therefore has to do more work. You can't rest so much. I remember hearing that theory a long time ago. I don't know if it really works, but it's not really important enough, so don't look for any medical reasons. All it really means is you just go to sleep mindful, and if it's on your back or on your side, even if you go to sleep standing on your head, it doesn't really matter as long as you're comfortable. Okay. And... Wait, I've got no... Okay. So in other words, you don't just end up just sleeping all day. When Agi was saying, Agi Waisana 19, this is a gradual training, yes, go on. I always say it's better to wake up when you wake up. It's better just to do it naturally. Because I know just as a monk that sometimes you try to actually to sleep very little. And afterwards you get so dull when you were meditating. It's just because you didn't have enough sleep. Even food, I remember just first year as a monk, I was getting really low energy. And I asked another monk, can you give me some meditation to rise more energy? And he said, I've been watching you, not eating enough rice. And so I just ate a little bit more rice and my energy came back. It was obvious, that was the fuel in your body, I wasn't eating enough. So now keep it simple. And just eat as much as you need to feel healthy. And also to sleep as much as you need to feel fresh. When Agi Waisana, the noble disciple, is devoted to wakefulness, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. So training the elephant further. Come, monk, be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. Act in full awareness when going forward and returning. Now, that's not such a good translation here, because it's sati sampajanya. Mindfulness is sati sampajanya, literally means with wisdom. And it's actually, even the commentaries explain that, is the purpose of what you're doing it for, and how you're going to achieve that purpose. So like sleeping, what's the purpose of sleeping? And you're learning how to rest properly. So when you know the purpose of sleeping, you know how to sleep, then the answer, should you get up after 3 hours or 4 hours or 6 hours? The answer is very clear, whenever you feel rested. So in each of these things, it's not just mindfulness and full awareness, mindfulness and wisdom. Act in wisdom when going forward and returning. When looking ahead and looking away. And I mention that because sometimes when people say it's just in full awareness when you're walking, going and coming, there was that story when a year and a half ago I was at one of the United Nations International Waisak ceremonies in Hanoi, and being like a celebration and also a conference, many of you who have been to conference, you have the plenary sessions when you get one speaker giving a lecture, and then you have what they call the breakout sessions when you go to smaller groups. And they always have a moderator in each of the smaller groups on certain subjects, and the moderator has to take notes of the discussion and has to present the findings to the whole conference later on. So at that conference there was about 7 or 8 breakout sessions on different aspects of Buddhism in the modern age, whether it's using IT or ways of teaching or whatever else it was. And then afterwards, every moderator would come up. They were sitting up there, about 8 people on the bench in front of everybody on stage. And then the MC would invite each one to please go to the lectern and present the findings. And there was one person who was a nun, won't say what tradition she was in. She was asked to give the report of her proceedings, and so she got up very mindfully. In full awareness, as she lifted up from the seat, has her legs straightened, and very carefully she moved around and lifted her left foot slowly with full awareness of every movement in her feet and in her legs. And she moved that foot forward and placed it on the ground. They only had about 10 minutes for each presenter, and she used 5 of those minutes getting to the lectern. And it was hilarious. Everyone was laughing. Because that's not the right time to do slow walking. Now that's completely opposite to what the Buddha was saying here. It's not full awareness, but with wisdom, knowing the purpose, what you're doing this for. There is a time when the purpose is to do as mindfully aware as you possibly are when you're on a meditation retreat. When you're crossing the road in busy traffic, or in this particular case, when you're actually walking from the stage to the podium, people are waiting for you, everyone's only got 10 minutes, that's a time to walk fast. That's actually walking with wisdom. So it doesn't mean you're always going slow. Acting full awareness when going forward and returning, acting with wisdom when looking ahead and looking away. What are you looking forward for? What are you looking away for? When flexing, extending your limbs, wearing your robes, carrying your outer robe and bowl, when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. When defecating and urinating, you're just aware of what the purpose of that is. When walking, standing, sitting, now where it says here falling asleep, it doesn't say falling asleep in Nepali. This is a common mistake of translators. Instead of translating what the word actually says, they translate what the word should be according to their understanding. It actually means asleep. Waking up means awake, talking and keeping silent. And the reason why, even I think it was actually Jnanaponika wrote falling asleep, when he knew the word meant asleep, was how can you be fully aware when you're asleep? No one can be fully aware when they're asleep. Being asleep by definition means you're not aware. So therefore he put falling asleep, being aware as you're falling asleep. And that has caused so much confusion to many meditators. It means you've got to be really, really aware when you're falling asleep. Notice the last breath when you're just about to fall asleep, which means you don't fall asleep. You're so tense and anxious. So that's not what it actually means. It means being asleep, being awake. Because the error there was thinking that this was being mindful. It's knowing the purpose of being asleep. And knowing the reason why you're supposed to be asleep. It's acting with mindfulness and wisdom. So in other words, what's the purpose of being asleep? So you just sleep as much as you need to rest. And talking and keeping silent. So if you're talking, there's a reason for it. If you're silent, there's a reason for it. So when Agyawesana, the noble disciple, possesses mindfulness and wisdom, so take off the full awareness there, put wisdom, sati sampajanya, or what in the Thai forest tradition, it was always sati panya, which was, you know, their equivalent to sati sampajanya. When Agyawesana, the noble disciple, possesses mindfulness and wisdom, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, monk, resort to a secluded resting place, a forest, the foot of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a jhana ground, a jungle thicket, a jhana grove meditation retreat center, or a heap of straw. A plug there for our retreat center. In other words, a nice, calm, peaceful, quiet place. But I would stop here. You see that one does need that training, first of all, some restraint of the senses, keeping like precepts, and also a bit of like mindfulness and awareness of what you're doing. Because otherwise you put a person in a retreat center and they haven't had some training and then they just don't know what to do. And it's been that case many times. You get people coming to our monasteries and they just, you know, they're having a really difficult time at home. They just want to go and retreat. And they go over there and they've got nothing to do. And they just go around talking to the Anagarikas, bothering people, trying to sort of, you know, because they're such a restless mind. They haven't got the basic training yet, which means they can't make use of that opportunity. And even in our monastery, you know, we give like 2-week retreats to some monks, sometimes novices, sometimes Anagarikas. But before they can actually do a retreat, they really have to know how to restrain their thinking. And especially when you go on long retreats. You know, like, I still remember I went on that 6-month silent retreat. You know, when I was didn't see anybody or speak to anybody. It's only because I've got good meditation you can do such things. It would send many people mad, just in solitude for such a long time. So if you've done your training, then you have got mindfulness of wisdom, you are restrained because you've trained in the precepts, you are a peaceful person, then it's the time to go to those secluded places and then you can make the best use of them. Otherwise, you just end up thinking too much and going crazy. And again, I remember this lovely experiences in my life as a monk. There was this very famous rishi, this hermit, in the north of Thailand. I think it was Receiving Dawn. His name was quite a famous, Tony Thai people here know Receiving Dawn. He's a very famous hermit. And at that particular time, I was supposed to only be second monk. I forget who was supposed to be the first monk, but they're always away, traveling and teaching, just like I do these days. So I was the second monk, and so they brought this rishi into to see me, just to visit Wat Nanachar. And I was really interested. Wow, this is a real rishi who spent about 7 or 8 years in the cave and hadn't come out. And I mean, he was just like a rishi out of the movies. I mean, he had really long hair, big wide eyes, it looked really freaky. And if anyone would like sort of like a rishi on a TV show, he'd be the guy. He really looked the part. And he was as crazy as anything. He was as mad as an owl. He was just, what he said was just totally off the planet. And I know now meditation, you can tell whether a person's wise or whether they're crazy. He was crazy. And it just, that's the first time I saw how you can be crazy by staying alone too long. But of course, it was so weird and so strange. People didn't know the difference between being crazy and being mad. And he said some really weird things that they're trying to think out. What's the deep meaning of that? It had no meaning at all. It was absolutely bunkum. It was a really, really interesting experience seeing a real rishi. And that's because they hadn't done the original training, the pre-training, so you can make the best use of such solitude. So anyone who has a romantic idea, yeah, I'm just going to give me a nice cave, a nice little caravan in the bush. I'm going to be alone. I'm going to be a hermit. I'm going to be a castaway on an island and just stay by myself for the next year or 2 years to get away from it all. You might be able to get away from the world, but you never be able to get away from your mind. And if that's not well trained, that's what will drive you crazy. So this is a gradual training. You train yourself up to this. And then you can start to get into some incredible solitude. So what do you do when you're in solitude? Number 21. You resort to a secluded resting place, a forest, a heap of straw, whatever it is, a quiet place. And these days you can do that in your homes. Because sometimes you go to some of these forests, especially in Asia, it's much quieter in your house. It is true. Because sometimes there's so many people come to these forest monasteries. And there's all the sound of the animals in the forest and the people. And in your house, especially in a place like Perth, you can close the windows and sometimes it's really quiet. You can't hear anything. I still remember once going up to the old Thai Airways office. I think it was in Spring Street. And there was this big Airways, this office which was vacated right next to it. And I just walked in there and it was absolutely quiet. It was in the middle of the CBD. I thought, wow, it's amazing. This is where you can have a nice forest monastery, just in a CBD tower. Because there's no noise there at all. There's no flies, no ticks, no other little things which mess you up. Those people who stayed in forest monasteries here in Australia know what I'm talking about. It was absolutely quiet. And no one was going up there. So you can have solitude in the most weird places. But anyhow, so any place which is quiet. So you resort to a secluded resting place, a forest, a heap of straw, an empty office and a CBD tower. On returning from your arms round after your meal, you sit down, folding your legs crosswise, setting your body erect, and establishing mindfulness as a priority. Not before you. That, again, is one of those really confusing translations. Which, I don't know how many years I thought that must mean mindfulness before me, because there's a Westerner, I thought I was in here, between my ears somewhere, behind my eyes, that's where I lived. And so mindfulness before me must mean in front here. My nose, the tip of my nose, that's where I should be mindful. And realizing that that was a big mistake. And for me, the big mistake was I had hay fever. So half the time I couldn't find my breath in my nose, it was stuffed. And there was a time I thought I'd never get enlightened that way because I must have done some terrible karma having hay fever, having a blocked nose, therefore I couldn't do meditation. And realize, no, you don't need to do it that way. It doesn't mean mindfulness before you. Pulakata means as a priority. I mean, the first thing is to establish mindfulness, not watching the breath or getting nimittas or whatever. The first thing you have to do, the priorities, get mindful first of all. So that's what it means. And you can understand the reason. Priority means you put ahead of other things. And that's what it means by putting in front. Not putting physically in front, but putting in front of your list of things to do. Making it a priority. So you make mindfulness a priority. And that, you know how I mean there, that's usually just present moment awareness and silence. Now this is interesting. Abandoning covetous for the world, he abides with the mind free from covetous. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, you abide with the mind free from ill will. Compassionate for the welfare of all beings, you purify your mind from ill will. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. You purify your mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with the mind inwardly peaceful. You purify your mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, you abide having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. You purify your mind from doubt, having thus abandoned these five hindrances. Now these are the five hindrances. And of course, hopefully you've noticed, here the first hindrance is called covetousness, instead of sensory desire. It's exactly the same word we had earlier, covetous and grief for the world. Covetousness is sometimes, or the word which is translated as covetousness, which is abhija, is a simile for kamachanda, the Pali word for the first hindrance. So covetousness actually means the first hindrance. Now actually, what does it actually mean? It means no free from desiring things. It doesn't mean free from owning things, which is what the covetousness means in English. To covet something means you want to own it and possess it for yourself. That's not what the word means in Pali. The word means it's just another synonym for the same word, same meaning as sensory desire. Now, the hindrance of ill will, you abide with a mind free from ill will, means you're compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. And it's not just all living beings, it's even for mind states. You're compassionate for the welfare of all your mind states, for all the dogs who make all the noise, for all the ticks who itch on your body, for all the flies who go up your nose. May all beings be happy and well, so you don't have any ill will or anger whatsoever at all for anybody. Abandon sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light. Now what does it mean, percipient of light? Does that mean you have to sort of, you know, turn the light on to get rid of sloth and torpor? Does that mean you have to look at the light globe when you get tired? Does that mean that somehow you have to get nimittas up and lights in the mind? All that really means is the sloth and torpor is low energy of the mind. As you've all heard me teach, the reason why you've got low energy is because you're tired. And if you start fighting that sloth and torpor, you are just wasting the little energy you have on a fight which makes the sloth and torpor last longer. So let it be. Stop fighting. Preserve your energy. Don't waste even the slightest bit of energy trying to change things. And then you find the energy comes back. As the energy grows, because the energy of the mind comes from stillness, it doesn't come from doing things. The more you are still, the more passive you are, the more energy you rouse in your mind. That's Ajahn Chah's great teaching, which is also in the suttas. The body becomes energetic through exercise, the mind becomes energetic through stillness. It becomes powerful. So you keep still, and as the mind gets more and more energized, and you do actually, many people see the energy just as a light in the mind. Sometimes people actually see this light screen, as if you've got not just a nimitta, which is like a focus light, but just light spread across the mind. That's the only reason that happens, is because your mind is energized. That's what happens when you get so far beyond sloth and torpor, it just can't really come up. The mind is energized, that's just the way it appears. The light which you see in the mind, not just a focused light, but a diffused light which you experience, that is just a sign the mind is energized and gone way beyond sloth and torpor. Okay? And then Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. No matter how many times you pick up the glass of water with some water in, unagitated. How do I stop the water being agitated? If you try and hold it, it's always agitating it. You put it down, then it becomes peaceful. That is restlessness and remorse. Because you're holding the mind, you'll always be restless. You put it down, then it's not agitated. So remember, the opposite of restlessness and remorse is no agitation. And who's the only person who can agitate your mind? I can't agitate your mind. Your wife and husband, they can't agitate it. It's not their fault. You agitate your mind. So you just put it down, and it gets perfectly still. So restlessness and remorse, you leave it alone. And also, you've got to leave it down for a long time. As the old simile goes, is my cup still yet? No, not yet. When's it going to come still? Still yet? Are you still? When are you going to become still? Come on, be still. Of course, that's agitating it. Every time you try and do something, you're agitating it. So that word agitation is a very wonderful word, because that is not only tells you sort of what restlessness is and its cause, it makes it very clear how to overcome that restlessness. Stop agitating things. Leave them alone. And they become still by themselves. So you purify your mind from restlessness and remorse by being unagitated. And abandoning doubt, you abide, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about these wholesome states. So these are wholesome states. And sometimes when you get to these states of meditation, sometimes people do have doubts. That's why they come and ask me, what is this? You know, it's very peaceful, but nothing's really happening. What should I do? And these are wholesome states. You know they're wholesome states. So you just stay there and enjoy them. And they just develop by themselves. You stop doing things. But sometimes people go into sort of sloth and torpor and sleepiness, the dull state. And sometimes they need to realize that's not what meditation is all about. The mindfulness and the awareness is very bright. You see these things very clearly. And that's what samadhi is all about. So this is a bit extra information about the five hindrances. What about trailing the elephant? Any questions on that? So now we get to the interesting thing. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom. The five hindrances, imperfections of the mind. As if like the Buddha often used a simile of gold. The imperfections in gold, other trace elements, stop you being able to make that into jewelry or into other things which are very useful. Real gold is pure and it's very easy to work with when the imperfections are got rid of. And the imperfections of the mind are these five hindrances. And they weaken wisdom. So if you want to have insight, wisdom, you have to abandon these five hindrances. Abandon them. So you abide, having overcome these five hindrances, you abide contemplating the body. Take off body as body. Again, I mentioned that that is a very unhelpful mistranslation. In Pali, they always repeat words over much. You dishwash dishes in Pali. What else can you dishwash except dishes? You floor sweep floors. You wall paint walls. And they always have this way of repeating things in Pali. So literally it means you do body contemplation on the body. What else will you do body contemplation? So in English, we just say, you contemplate the body. Ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. Remember, this has come straight after the five hindrances have been put away. The covetous and grief for the world mean the five hindrances. You abide contemplating feelings, mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. That would be the more accurate translation. Just as, Agiwesana, the elephant tamer plants a large post in the earth and binds a forest elephant to it by the neck in order to subdue his forest habits and to inculcate in him habits congenial to human beings, So the four foundations of mindfulness are the bindings for the mind of the noble disciple in order to subdue his habits based on the household life, to subdue the memories and intentions based on the household life, to subdue their distress, fatigue and fever based on the household life, in order that he may attain the true way and realize nibbana. Now the interesting thing is, I'm just going to go quickly onto paragraph 24 and 25. Then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come monk, abide contemplating the body, but do not think thoughts connected with the body. Abide contemplating feelings, but do not think thoughts connected with feelings. Abide contemplating mind, but do not think thoughts connected with the mind. Abide contemplating mind objects, but do not think thoughts connected with mind objects. And then, 25, with the stilling of the applied or sustained thought, you enter upon and abide in the second jhana, the third jhana and the fourth jhana. And the amazing thing here is there's no mention of the first jhana in the usual sequence of things. Yes, Jacob. Now that would be much better, because here, abide contemplating the body, but do not think thoughts connected with the body. It doesn't, no, because for many people the word contemplation is very much a sort of a Christian monastic term, means thinking about it. So again, this is like an experiencing, knowing the body without sort of thinking about it. But obviously, first of all, the person has too many thoughts, and here we're saying just let those thoughts disappear, and then you get into the second jhana. Now this is interesting here, because always, I know as a meditator, once the five hindrances disappear, you're on the door of the first jhana, and you can't get to the second jhana without going to the first jhana. So here we have a whole sequence which has a difference to all the other times, and many times this gradual training is in the suttas, and the difference is paragraph 21 is usual, and now instead of just having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, then usually have he enters upon the abides in the first jhana. And instead we have you abide contemplating the body, the feelings, the mind and mind objects. It's as if you take another route into Satipatthana, and then you go into second jhana. Or is it another route, or is it a different way of saying the same thing? You got a question there, go on. How do you experience the body? Oh. Independent of the senses. The word obviously is kai anusati. Anusati means mindfulness along with, literally. So it just means awareness. So it is much better translation to say experiencing the body. So there's many ways you can experience the body. But also, when we come down to what you're saying here about the thinking, abide experiencing the body, but do not think thoughts connected with the body. And remember that the thoughts in this particular case, the word is vitaka, vichara, and that whole word, thinking, starts to get a different meaning in Pali, in the Buddhism, when you start to move into deep meditation. It is what I've often described as the movement of the mind which goes on to these objects. It is the subverbal part of thinking. A thought occurs, you move onto an object, and then it breaks into thought. But it's before it breaks into that verbalization is what we call subverbal thinking. So here in this particular case, the Buddha is saying even the subverbal part, let that go as well. So by contemplating the body, you're experiencing it without any thoughts, And you all know that great simile of Lao Tzu, where the student saw the sunset and said, "What a beautiful sunset." He wasn't watching the sunset anymore, he was just watching the words. It's a very, very great simile. That's why I repeat it so often. Every time you think, "What a beautiful sunset," you're not experiencing the sunset. You're experiencing the words. You're experiencing the signpost, not the place where it's pointing to. So that's why what we think is contemplation, the thinking part, you're missing the experience. You're just watching the commentary rather than the action. So your point is very true. For real contemplation, it's experiencing these things, subverbally. But the Buddha is saying, put even aside that subverbal movement onto things. Get rid of that vitaka vichara, that particular wobble, which actually moves the mind here and there to get into the second jhana. Because what I'm doing here is using this, the paragraph 22, 23 and 24, to see how this is representing even a first jhana. And how we can actually use this, because this is a very strange sutra. As most monks look at this sutra and say, this is weird, the first jhana is absent here in the list. It's not explicitly mentioned, but we all know you can't access the second jhana except with the first jhana. So we go from abandoning the five hindrances to the second jhana in this sutra. First jhana is missing. So paragraph 22 and 23, this must represent a first jhana somehow. It gives us more information about what a first jhana could be. Yeah. So this is the interesting part. It is, yes. So, but if it's experiencing a body, now many of you may have heard me give the simile of the tadpole before. Now, the simile of the tadpole, one of my favorite similes, a tadpole born in water, lived all its life in water, can't know what water is. But one day a tadpole grows into a frog, jumps outside of the water, and realizing something is missing. And now for the first time the tadpole can understand what water is. That which is missing, which is not there anymore. How can a tadpole know what water is? How does a fish know what water is? It cannot know what water is. It's always there. But when something goes for the first time, then you understand, that's what water is. You know it by its absence. Sorry? No. No, that you can understand that simile, first of all. So when anything disappears, then you can really know it. So sometimes it's valid to say, and it's a valid interpretation, at that particular point when the body disappears, that's the only time you can have an experience of what body truly is. That which is now absent. That's what body was. How on earth can you know what the body is when you've lived with your body for your whole life? How do you know what the five senses are? You've been surrounded by them. These are the things we take for granted because they've always been there. And one day they vanish. Wow, this is weird. Now you know what it was. You know it by its absence. So that's a valid explanation of what's happening here. So the contemplating of the body, or rather the experiencing of the body, for this Satipatthana, getting to understand what this body actually is now the body is gone. In the first jhana, as you would know, even if you've been following my teachings, experiential, by the time these five hindrances are gone, you don't know the body anymore. You're so peaceful, you can't hear, you can't see, you can't smell, taste, you can't touch. You're sitting there, the five hindrances are gone, someone taps you on the shoulder, the bell goes, you don't know. Deep in the meditation, not in jhana yet, but you can't feel your body. So how can that be contemplating the body? Answer is, because you're aware of what's gone. Contemplating by its absence. Exactly, yeah. experiencing the absence, like the frog experiences the absence of water. Do you get that? That's why it's called water contemplation. You can't contemplate water, experience water, when it's been around you all your life. It's impossible. Yes. Indeed. No, because remember, the word contemplation is not the best of translations. It confuses people. So, you know, if I was retranslating this, I would use Jay's translation, experiencing. Experiencing the body. But even that, so experiencing something through its disappearance, again, doesn't make sense. Yeah? It's resting, it's experiencing a state where there's no agitation. And because it's not agitated, that's why the things disappear. Stillness causes things to vanish. Movement causes things to appear. So, because things have vanished like your body, you know that something is gone. It's an experience, it's a knowing, it's a mindfulness, it's an awareness. So you might just say, instead of contemplating the body, just sustained awareness of the body, if you like. Anusati means mindfulness along with, mindfulness following something. And this is how we can take what's said here, interpret it in the framework of a first jhana somewhere, that when it says, having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfection of mind that weaken wisdom, you abide experiencing the body in its absence, experiencing feelings in mostly their being absent. There's still a few feelings, the mind feeling there. Experiencing the mind. The mind is certainly there now in the jhanas. And mind objects, the piti sukha. And just as the elephant tamer plants a large post in the earth and binds a forest elephant to it by the neck in order to subdue his forest habits, and to inculcate in him habits congenial to human beings, so these four focuses of mindfulness, I call them, are bindings for the mind of the noble disciple. Because really it's only in those deep meditations that they subdue sort of the lust and the ill will. And to subdue sort of the memories and intentions of the lay life, because now you've got a pleasure, a happiness, a what it's called in the Sandhika Sutta, a satisfaction, a contentment, which is this time based on the holy life. And that, if you get into enough of those first jhanas, that will subdue your distress, fatigue and fever based on the life you've left. So in order that you may attain the true way and realize nirvana, so you might carry on further. I think it's the Sandhika Sutta when they say, what is the word they use? It's quite a good word. Consolation, thank you. It's the first consolation of the holy life. Imagine like a monk and nun, they've given up all of their sex, all of their freedoms to get the food they want, to watch movies, to see this and do that. All the things that they love doing, they've given up their Jimi Hendrix records and their Led Zeppelin CDs. And now what consolation do you have? And again, the main consolation according to this sutra is the first jhana. That's the first real consolation a monk has. In other words, that which gives them the opportunity to really let go of their distress, fatigue and fever. If monks and nuns get into that first jhana, of course they never want to disrobe.
So before the experience of the first jhana, this pure endurance run,
It's not just pure endurance, because some of the other monks have pointed out, though actually that's what the Buddha says, the real consolation. There's also the consolation of compassionate work, service, giving, and even just the consolation of living a pure lifestyle. That's right, yes. Even keeping precepts gives you a consolation. But the Buddha was actually saying this. This is an interesting one. And sometimes monks could argue from their experience maybe the Buddha was being a bit too strict on this particular point. But I think what you're saying is true. Just living a good lifestyle gives many monks a lot of fulfillment. I know many monks who haven't got very good meditation at all, but they do great service for the world. Talking about some of the monks I used to know in Thailand. They weren't great meditators, they're just such kind beings. They would help many, many people. They were very kind and good and very wise. And they would help a lot of people. They got a lot of fulfillment for their life from the service they gave to their community. So in that particular context, I think the Buddha was a bit sort of too strict when he says the first consolation is the first jhana. Because there's many other consolations from living the life of a monk or a nun. There's many more consolations of living the life of a Buddhist. You get a lot of fun, you know, hanging out with good people, you know, just listening to some Dharma. That itself is a consolation, even if you don't get the first jhana. But nevertheless, the Buddha is actually saying here, this is really is a big consolation, the first major prize you win. Yeah, go on. Yeah, that's a good. It's a contemplation which is based on experience of something different. You have data. The same way being a scientist, you got to get the experiment, get the data in, and then you can understand how it all works together. And you know that sometimes in science, I'm just thinking of that Hadron Collider in CERN. Cost, I don't know how many billions of dollars just to get this huge experiment going. But that experiment is going to unlock many secrets. And the experiment of deep meditation, again, takes a lot of resources, a lot of time to develop your mind. But then it unlocks the great secrets of the nature of the mind and the universe. That's the enlightenment secrets. So the word is not to contemplate, the word is anusati, which means mindfulness along with. So mindfulness along with, awareness with something, following it, it's like investigate, not really investigating, that's too active. I like, make, if you like, sustained awareness. When it comes back again, yes, so you're aware when it disappears. So when you come back again, you realize, wow, something's disappeared. What was that? And that gives you the data to get the understanding. Yes, Jay? Could you speak up? Can hear? Oh, yeah, quiet and peaceful mind would be a consolation. Great. Yeah, again, I think I was just quoting that particular sutta where the Buddha said the first consolation for monastic life is the first jhana. And as I pointed out, many people I think would agree, there are other consolations. But he said that's the big main consolation, the big one. But nevertheless, now these paragraphs over here, which is for me the most interesting part of this sutta, having abandoned the five hindrances, you're doing a satipatthana. This is a four satipatthanas here. The abandoned five hindrances, abide, aware of the body, aware of body, of feelings, mind objects, how that can actually, what that means in sense of the first jhana. Body is gone, most feelings have gone. Mind is very clear, and mind objects, the pitti sukha in the mind. And this is how the elephant tamer trains the elephants, how the Buddha trains his monks. Get them into that first jhana. And that will take away all their worldliness. The consolation is the prize. How you achieve that prize, you can actually see the whole gradual process over here. Of keeping precepts, being restrained, simplifying the life. But then when it gets to putting aside the five hindrances here, that's where the striving goes against the five hindrances. The striving agitates the mind and creates more restless. So the striving, certainly for the first part, to keep precepts, that takes a lot of striving. You know, to actually define the quiet places. Now, even to restrain the senses takes striving. But when it gets to this part, when you sit on the meditation cushion, that's where you become peaceful. So, what I've done here is I've shown that number 22 can be interpreted as the first jhana, and that the consolation of the first jhana and how it's used to train the monks is the meaning of 23. And the 24, this is the Buddha actually saying, discipline further, come monk, abide experiencing, I'm going to cheat here a little bit, abide experience the absence of a body, but do not think thoughts connected with the body, those vitakka vichara, the wobble, which is the echo of that body awareness. Abide experiencing the feelings, but don't allow those feelings to create vitakka vichara, the wobble. To be able to experience the mind in that first jhana, but do not allow that to create the wobble. And abide contemplating mind objects, but do not allow those to create a wobble. In other words, to subdue that what I've called, the word which I've used, the wobble of the first jhana, where you're in an incredibly deep, powerful state, but there is still a movement of the mind discerned. It's not totally still. And from that, 24 is just the Buddha telling you to abandon something which will take you from the first to the second jhana. So the stilling of the applied and sustained thought, the vitakka vichara, is not thinking, it's a subverbal movement of the mind onto the object of bliss. And because it's moving onto it, you grab onto it, and therefore you move away again, you keep grabbing onto it again. That's the only way you can describe that. Then you abide in the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. And that is as the usual way of describing these jhana experiences. So that was a difficult part of the sutta, but the interesting part, I hopefully, because this is something you don't usually hear. So the first jhana was absent actually in the text, and I've used the Satipatthana here to show that is first jhana. And obviously, if you accept that explanation, you will understand that what is supposed to be the heart of vipassana practice, the Satipatthana, is now seen to be a first jhana experience, which is supposed to be typical samatha. In other words, as always, there is no separation between vipassana and samatha. Satipatthana practice, jhana practice, they are absolutely together. And this one sutta, that probably is one of those suttas which makes it the most clear that satipatthana and jhana are combined in this sutta. From here on in, it's just the usual stuff, the great stuff. When the mind is sort of concentrated, is stilled and purified, then you understand, let's go for the whole lot from Sutta 51. Because this is, I don't like it when they always abbreviate too much, because it misses such beautiful teachings. When the mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. Just like the elephant is imperturbable. And it's malleable, just like gold is workable when all of the when all of the imperfections are taken away, then you direct it to the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. And having remembered many past lives, then you use that still mind, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, to direct it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings according to karma. Then, when your mind is purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to the knowledge of the destruction of the outflowings of the mind, and also the Four Noble Truths. So you understand this is suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the way leading to cessation of suffering. And when you know and see thus, your mind is liberated from the outflowing of sensory desire, from the outflowing of being, and from the outflowing of delusion. And when it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. I usually pause there because when I was young, some people said, oh, you can be enlightened but not know it. And here it's very clear that when you are liberated, there comes a knowledge it is liberated. In other words, there's no possibility of being enlightened and not knowing about it. So this next thing which comes is the knowledge of enlightenment. And you understand. Now we come here. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Now that monk is able to endure cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, ticks, wind. We've got lots of ticks in our monastery. Gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, ticks, the sun and creeping things. He's able to endure ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing and menacing to life. Being rid of all lust and hate and delusion, purged of flaws, he is worthy of gifts, hospitality, offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, unsurpassed field of merit for the world. That's the Arahat. Now sometimes people always say, how do you know someone's enlightened? And here we've got a test. An enlightened person is able to endure cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, ticks, wind, the sun, and creeping things. So you could always throw a snake at an enlightened being to see what they do, but that's not a very good idea. But the next one is the usual test. You are able to endure ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing and menacing to life. So it's usually you see how a person reacts when they are criticized, when they are abused, when they are shouted at. That's usually the way. So if a person reacts, then they have not got enlightened yet. And also when they're experiencing feelings, to see how they react to pain, especially at the end of their life when they've got very disagreeable feelings. So being rid of all lust, hate, delusion, purge of flaws, they are Ahunayo, Pahunayo, Dakinayo, Anjali, Karaniyo, Anuttarang, Punya, Ketang, Lokasa, as you chant in the Triple Gem chanting. The chanting you do here, the chanting you do on retreats, that's what it means. That such a person, an Arahat, is truly worthy of gifts, of hospitality, offerings, of reverential salutations. They are an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. In other words, if you give dana to them, you get 100 times, 1,000 times, million times more bang for your bucks than if you give it to an ordinary Joe of a monk. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Why is that an order of the realizations after you come out of the jhanas? Your mind is malleable and wieldy, and you recall past lives to have the big picture of suffering, because one life is really not enough to give you the whole story of what suffering is all about, because you've been actually born in a really good life. This is actually, You know, it's still the human realm, but you know, being born in this age, you know, in Western countries, this is like a heaven realm. It's not that far off. But next lifetime, you may be reborn in Darfur. Or what's another really rotten place to get reborn into? You may be reborn in England in the cold weather. That's pretty. I just saw in the newspapers just how cold that is. Wow, that must be hell at the moment. The cold hell, but whatever. You may be reborn in Adelaide. I heard that's going through a heat spot. Whatever. You're born in a really nice place. Okay, so you know, if it's just this life and you happen to, you know, escape from cancer and have a good sort of relationship and do reasonably well and have no great suffering, then many people who have a pretty good life. So they can't see, you know, the whole of suffering just in this one life. If you can remember your past lives and see the whole big picture, now that gives a totally different angle on what suffering is. So I know there was, there's a movie, Groundhog Day. So this was, I must admit, I did watch that on an aircraft once because Ron Battersby, remember Ron Battersby, he was going on about it. He said, this is real Buddhism, this is really what it is. And it just happened, I think, he took me to Sri Lanka, this was years and years ago, and he was saying, what a great movie this is, you should see, this is real Dhamma. And on the way back, and I didn't travel back with him, forget where I think he went back earlier. I travelled back on myself. And it just happened to be the in-flight movie. So I actually asked for the headphones and I saw it. So I admit I watched that, but that was for Dhamma. And it was actually true. It was. I mean, there's this guy. He was experiencing the same day over and over again. And he was actually making it really interesting. But after a while he got so fed up going through the same day, even though you could make it any way you want. And all of his dreams could be fulfilled. I think one of the things, he always wanted to be a musician. So you know, he could manage to sort of learn the piano again and again and again and again. After that, how many thousands of days, he could play his piano really, really well. So what? After a while, he just got so fed up. He tried to commit suicide and you know, he killed himself many times. He'd just wake up the following morning again. That's what happens. So it was, after a while, it was just the ennui, the boredom, the suffering of having to go over this again and again, another life, another day. And unfortunately, because it was a movie, if I was a director of that, you know, he would have actually meditated and got out of it. But of course, being Hollywood, what did he do? He fell in love. And as soon as he fell in love, the spell was broken. That just sucks, that ending. Set him free. No, that wasn't set him free. He just gets entangled in another layer of samsara. But anyway, leave the ending alone. The first part of it was really neat. And seeing rebirth like that just gives you a big idea what suffering is. Even if it's a beautiful life, after so many years, so many lifetimes, I've had enough. So that's one of the first of those. And also just how it works, how you get reborn. The law of karma, cause and effect. Why these things happen without a soul, a self, this impersonal force which drives you from life to life. So those are the two great insights. Well, in another sutta, the Buddha said, when a chick is hatching, the first crack in the egg is actually seeing sort of reincarnation. The second crack is when you see the law of karma. And now those two big cracks, then the chicken can poke its head out and escape from the egg. So these are actually important insights. And they're actually mentioned here again, yeah. Oh, no. It means... What that paragraph means, you understand how karma works. A general principle. That's right.
Because
is very simplified, it's very dodgy. Correct. A good monk who understands karma would never say that. So, but you see the general principles of karma. No, you don't. No, there's many things you will never know. There's too much to know. You can't keep it all, but you know the general principles of the law of karma. That's what's meant to be. You know what dependent origination, you know how rebirth. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. Very good. But you've been going to the wrong temple. You're reading the wrong books. Okay, point taken. Yeah. Just like the law of gravity, you know, you understand the general principle, so then you can apply it. Okay, let's get going, because we're going over time. So, paragraph 31. If Agyavesana, going back to the simile, the king's elephant dies in old age, untamed and undisciplined, then he is considered an old elephant that has died an untamed death. If the king elephant dies in middle age, untamed and undisciplined, you consider a middle-aged elephant that's died an untamed death. If the king's elephant dies when young, untamed and undisciplined, he is considered a young elephant that's died an untamed death. So too, Agyavesana, if an elder monk dies with his taints undestroyed, not an arahat yet, then he is considered an elder bhikkhu who has died an untamed death. Similarly, a middle status, or a young, newly ordained monk, dies with his taints undestroyed, then he is considered a newly ordained monk who has died an untamed death. In fact, he was saying the king's elephant dies in old age, well-tamed and well-disciplined, he is considered an old elephant that has died a tame death. A middle-aged elephant, a young elephant, dies, he is considered to be a young, well-tamed and well-disciplined elephant who has died a tame death. So too, Agi was saying that if an elder monk dies with his taints destroyed, he's considered an elder monk who has died a tame death. If a monk of middle status, or a newly ordained monk, dies with his taints destroyed, he is considered a newly ordained monk who has died a tamed death. Doesn't matter how old, young, or middle you are, the most important thing is to tame yourself so you are like a royal layman, laywoman, monk or nun, who's died a tamed death. Who has seen the truth and who has got to the top of the mountain and see the beautiful fields of Nibbana stretched out as far as the eye cannot see. That is what the Blessed One said. The novice Achiravata was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So there is the gradual training with a twist, and started off because this prince was saying about meditation and jhana, saying it's impossible. He said, of course it's impossible for you. It's probably someone who tried meditation and couldn't do it. Why? Because he was probably hanging around in his harem all day and eating too much and just not watching movies. They didn't have watching movies in those days, but watching his dancing girls, because those were princes. That's what they got up to in those days. So that's why he could actually unify his mind. So as for us, we make sure we live a restrained life. And especially when the time we have for meditation, we can let go of everything, and who knows, we may be able to get these states. And when we get these states, you'll understand the nature of the body, feelings, mind, and mind objects, through the experience of when these things disappear. And then you become a well-tamed elephant. Answer paid. Yeah. That's right, if you offer to an arahat fully enlightened. As they say, a small investment, huge returns. It's like finding that super company on the stock market. Guaranteed, the returns will always, the stock price will always go up, and the returns every year will just be huge. So that's the best investment. And this is one of the reasons why no monk or nun ever tells who is the stock market on the up and up in the karma stock market. In not Wall Street, in Samsara, not Samsara, no, Samsara Street, yeah. Of Vitaka. Dantabhumi. Danta means like trained. It means disciplined. It means developed. So usually because trained, usually because you need a teacher to help you train. So that's someone who's trained. And bhumi just means the ground or the land. Like the, you know, you were in Malaysia before. Bhumiputra, the sons of the land. Or Bhumipon, the Thai king, means Bhumipala, the protector of the land. Basic training, yeah. But this is the, you know, the ground, the land of the trade. Yeah, go on. It's not really basic training, but the whole field of training. Yeah. No, the karma is the way things, the cause and effect relationship. The asavas are the outflowings of the mind. Why your mind won't stay home. Why it goes out thinking of this and going out there. They're all related. But the asavas, you might say, are what creates delusion, which creates karma. The asavas are just more deeply.